and reducing hyperactivity, such as a relatively new non-stimulant medication called examoxetine, Strattera. Side effects of this medication include upset stomach, decreased appetite, nausea or vomiting, dizziness, fatigue, and mood swings. And atypical antidepressant called bupropion, Wellbutrin, has also been used to ameliorate hyperactivity impulsivity in children. Bupropion may increase the risk of seizures, exacerbate tics, cause insomnia, nausea, headache, constipation, tremor, and dry mouth, and can initially cause an increase in agitation. Antihypertensive medications include clonidine, catapress, and guanfacine, 10x, are also sometimes used to reduce hyperactivity and impulsivity, but they may be less effective for inattention. Antihypertensives can also be effective at reducing tics. In addition, because of their sedating effect, antihypertensives have been used to help children sleep at night. However, in some children, this sedation may be a problem during daytime hours and is sometimes manifested in the form of heightened irritability. In those explosive children whose difficulties involve the emotion regulation pathway, increased irritability is undesirable. Side effects can include headache, dizziness, nausea, constipation, and dry mouth. The tricyclic antidepressants, which include agents such as nortriptyline, pamelor, disipramine, norpramin, imipramine, tofranil, and clomipramine, anafranil, may also be prescribed to reduce hyperactivity and impulsiveness in children. An advantage of tricyclic medications is that they provide 24-hour coverage and typically do not interfere with sleep. One of the rare but more serious side effects of the tricyclic medications is cardiac toxicity, which often necessitates that children medicated with such agents undergo initial and then periodic electrocardiograms. There are a variety of additional potential side effects that may not be well tolerated by children, including dry mouth, weight gain, sedation, lightheadedness, and constipation. Irritability and obsessiveness. If irritability or obsessiveness is significantly interfering with your child's functioning at home or school, or with his ability to participate in Plan B discussions, medication may help. Irritability and obsessiveness in children have most often been treated with a group of medications called selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRI, antidepressants, which include agents such as fluoxetine, Prozac, citrulline, Zoloft, paroxetine, Paxil, citalopram, Celexa, and fluvoxamine, Luvox. However, as of this writing, the use of these medications has become controversial owing to findings that these agents can cause increased suicidal thinking in some children. A fact that some of the manufacturers of these agents were apparently not completely forthcoming in disclosing. Other side effects include nausea, weight loss, or weight gain, anxiety, nervousness, insomnia, and sweating. Extremely short fuse. If despite heavy doses of Plan C, your child's fuse is still so short that he is incapable of participating in Plan B discussions, a class of medications called atypical antipsychotics, including medications such as risperidone, Risperdal, olanzapine, Zyprexa, quetiapine, Soraquel, and aripiprazole, Abilify, may be used. These medications have prompted much enthusiasm because they tend to be better tolerated than more traditional antipsychotics. However, these agents have been associated with sedation and significant weight gain, and may be associated with extrapyramidal symptoms such as odd mouth or tongue movements, eye rolling, rigidity in the limbs, fixed facial expression, blank emotions, and involuntary movements. These symptoms typically subside once the medication is discontinued. However, in rare instances, they may persist even after the child is taken off the medication, a condition called tardive dyskinesia. Another class of agents, broadly referred to as mood stabilizers, may also be prescribed, including lithium carbonate, carbamazepine, Tegretol, and valproic acid, Depakote. The mood stabilizers may be less effective in children who are predominantly dysphoric. Indeed, because these agents may produce drowsiness or fatigue, they may actually increase irritability in some children. All of these agents provide 24-hour coverage and typically do not affect the sleep of most children. Lithium can cause sedation, nausea, diarrhea, thirst, increased urination, mild tremor, and weight gain, and must be monitored closely. Valproic acid and carbamazepine may cause sedation, nausea, diarrhea, heartburn, tremor, and weight gain. Valproic acid can also cause liver toxicity, and carbamazepine can be associated with a decrease in white blood cell count and aplastic anemia. So the use of these agents requires periodic blood work. Less traditional agents, such as flaxseed oil and fish oil, have also been shown to have promising mood stabilizing effects. Indeed, some children may benefit from non-traditional, natural, or homeopathic agents. Although it's fine to be open to the use of such agents, it's important to note that they do have a chemical effect on a child's body. We have a tendency to view natural agents as somehow more benign, can produce undesirable side effects, often have not been carefully studied. Of course, the same can be said about many of the traditional psychiatric medications presently being prescribed for children, and must be taken under the supervision of a qualified professional. At the risk of redundancy, it should be clear that the most crucial component in the psychopharmacology picture is a competent, clinically savvy, attentive, available prescribing doctor. But the doctor can't treat your child successfully unless he or she receives accurate information from you and your child's teachers about the effects of the prescribed medications. When all relevant adults work in concert with the doctor, side effects are handled more efficiently and adjustments are made more responsibly. A discrete approach to medication is also recommended. Most children aren't eager for their classmates to know that they're receiving medication for emotional or behavioral purposes, and there's a temptation for parents to keep school personnel in the dark about their child's medication status as well. True to the collaborative spirit required for intervening effectively with explosive children, and because the observations and feedback of teachers are often crucial to making appropriate adjustments in medication, I generally encourage parents to keep relevant school personnel in the loop on medications. If there's no way to keep a child's classmates in the dark, it's often necessary to educate the classmates about individual differences, asthma, allergies, diabetes, difficulty concentrating, low frustration tolerance, and the like, that may require medicinal treatment. If you choose to medicate your child, for how long will you have to use medication? That's hard to predict. In general, the chemical benefits of these agents endure only as long as the medication is taken. Nonetheless, in some children, the behavioral improvements that are facilitated by medication persist even after the medications are discontinued, especially if a child has acquired new compensatory skills. Ultimately, the question of whether a child should remain on medication must be continuously revisited. Chapter 11, The Plan B Classroom. To help an explosive child within a family, it may be even harder in a classroom in the company of an additional 25 to 30 kids, many of whom have been types of special needs themselves. Like parents, most general education teachers have never been responsible for helping an explosive child and have never received any specialized training to prepare them for this task. Fortunately, most explosive kids don't actually show any signs of explosiveness at school. Here are a few possible explanations for this phenomenon, including some mentioned earlier. The embarrassment factor. They'd be embarrassed if they exploded in front of their peers, since the embarrassment factor can't be replicated at home embarrassment doesn't prevent the child from blowing up at home. The tightly wrapped factor. The child has put so much energy into holding it together at school that he becomes unraveled the minute he gets home, fueled further by normal late afternoon fatigue and hunger. The herd mentality factor. Because the school day tends to be relatively structured and predictable, it can actually be user-friendlier than unstructured downtime at home. For instance, if a child becomes confused about where he's supposed to be or what he's supposed to be doing while he's at school, he need look no further than his classmates for cues. The herd mentality factor can't be replicated at home either. The chemical factor. Teachers and peers often are the primary beneficiaries of pharmacotherapy, but the medications may have worn off by late afternoon or early evening. There are probably other possibilities, but just because a child isn't exploding at school doesn't mean that school isn't contributing to explosions that occur elsewhere. Lots of things can happen at school to fuel explosions outside of school. Being teased by other children, feeling socially isolated or rejected, feeling frustrated and embarrassed over struggles on certain academic tasks, being misunderstood by the teacher, and homework can extend school frustrations well after the bell rings at the end of the school day. So schools aren't off the hook for helping, even if they don't see the child at his worst. Of course, there are lots of kids who do explode at school. You may recall that Casey, one of the children you read about in Chapter 4, had a pattern of running out of the classroom when he became frustrated by a challenging academic task or difficult interaction with a peer. When he wasn't running out of the room, he was exploding in the room, turning red, crying, screaming, crumpling paper, breaking pencils, falling on the floor, and refusing to work. Danny, another of the children you read about in Chapter 4, was also capable of the occasional explosion at school. On one particularly memorable day, the teacher designated him to hand out donuts to his classmates after recess. Following recess, he hurried back to the classroom to hand out the donuts. But a parent aide was already in the room and insisted on being the donut distributor. Danny attempted to explain to the parent that he had been assigned the task of giving out the donuts. But the parent would not be deterred. The shift in cognitive set demanded by this example of reciprocal inflexibility was more than Danny could handle. Kaboom. Teachers and schools have little choice but to put some serious thought into how to handle the Caseys and Dannys in their midst. We live in the era of inclusion. By the way, that's a good thing, which has encouraged including students with special behavioral and academic needs in mainstream classrooms, thereby providing these students with opportunities to interact with ordinary kids and vice versa, and reducing the stigma of having special needs addressed outside of the classroom. Thus, a typical mainstream classroom is now likely to have numerous special needs students, some of whom have disorders their teachers have never even heard of, let alone worked with before. Teachers must, therefore, have expertise not only in the curriculum, but also in the different emotional and behavioral issues presented by some of their students, and how to handle those issues effectively. Unfortunately, in many instances, teachers feel, justifiably, that they have not had the training and are not being provided with the kind of support they need to function effectively with students with emotional and behavioral challenges. To make things worse, in the United States, we also live in the era of high-stakes testing, which places expectations on teachers to try to ensure that every square peg fits into the round holes defined by the standards imposed by statewide mandated testing. Not even a good idea if you're interested in raising standards, but most assuredly not a good idea if you want teachers to respond to the behavioral, social, and learning needs of individual students. And to make things still worse, the zero-tolerance-driven discipline program in most schools is very much a roadmap for Plan A. It's a list, sometimes a very long one, of things students can and can't do, and a list, sometimes a very long one, of what's going to happen if they do or don't do those things. But there's a true fact you might want to ponder for a moment. Standard school disciplinary practices don't work for the students to whom they are most frequently applied and aren't needed for the students to whom they are never applied. In other words, the school discipline program isn't the reason well-behaved students behave well. They behave well because they can. We have little to show for all the consequences, detentions, suspensions, expulsions, and so forth, that are meted out on a daily basis to the explosive students in our midst. And yet, the standard rationale for the continued use of consequences goes something like this. Administrator, we have to set an example for all our students. Even if suspension doesn't help Ricky, at least it sets an example for our other students. We need to let them know that we take safety seriously at our school. Question. What message do you give the other students at your school if you continue to apply interventions that aren't helping Ricky behave more adaptively? Answer. That you're actually not sure how to help Ricky behave more adaptively. Question. What's the likelihood that the students who aren't explosive would become explosive if you did not make an example of Ricky? Answer. As a general rule, slim to none. Question. What message do we give Ricky if we continue to apply strategies that aren't working? Answer. We don't understand you, and we can't help you. Question. Under what circumstances do we have the best chance of helping Ricky learn and practice better ways of dealing with his inflexibility and low frustration tolerance in school or suspended from school? Answer. In school. Question. Why do many schools continue to use interventions that aren't working for their explosive students? Answer. They aren't sure what else to do. Question. What happens to students to whom these interventions are counterproductively applied for many years? Answer. They become more alienated and fall further outside the social fabric of the school. Question. Isn't this the parent's job? Answer. Helping a child deal more adaptively with frustration is everyone's job. Besides, the parents aren't there when the child's exploding at school. Question. Isn't this the job of special education? Answer. No. Special education really has very little to offer many explosive students. Time for Plan B. But let's make sure the wagon is packed before we start heading into the wilderness. We're going to need a few things. A philosophy. Most students don't have a philosophy about children. What they have instead is a curriculum and a school discipline code, neither of which is much use when trying to figure out why a student is exploding and how to teach him the skills he needs to stop exploding. Your philosophy about children is what guides and governs your response when a student is not doing well. What's your new philosophy? You might want to consider children do well if they can. That way you won't waste a lot of time trying to teach him a lesson or find ways to give a student the incentive to do well. Good teachers know that although it would be more efficient to have all the students in a classroom have the exact same learning styles and capabilities, it never works out that way. So it's always necessary to adapt lessons and assignments to individual learners. The learning disability of inflexibility and poor tolerance for frustration is as good a reason to do Plan B as any other type of learning disability. Time. Teachers often complain that they don't have time to do Plan B. Of course, doing the right thing and fixing the problem always takes less time than doing the wrong thing and not fixing the problem. But it's absolutely true that the school schedule isn't designed to give school personnel the time they need to discuss a student's pathways, develop action plans for teaching the thinking skills a child lacks and using Plan B, and meeting periodically to assess the student's progress and reconfigure the action plan. On the other hand, what's done with the meeting time that does exist is often, don't take this the wrong way, please, a waste of time. Too much time is spent telling stories about the student's behavior rather than making sense out of the stories with the pathways. Too much time is spent agonizing and obsessing over categorization, Does he need a 504 plan or an IEP rather than developing action plans to get the job done? Expertise. Many educators apply to explosive students the same principles of discipline that were effective with their own children, generally with poor results. Other educators believe that the expertise necessary for understanding and helping an explosive child is well beyond their grasp. Not true. You need expertise in three domains, five pathways, three plans, and three steps for doing Plan B. So, chin up. If you've read the 10 chapters that preceded this one, you're well on your way in the expertise department. Now you just need experience. No time like the present. A Plan B roadmap. We're going to have to replace the school discipline code with something that will actually work. A roadmap for implementing Plan B. It's a pretty easy roadmap to follow. The first goal is to achieve a consensus on a given student's pathways and triggers. See Chapter 3. This usually requires a meeting or two involving all of the adults who interact with the child at school. It often makes sense to have parents and relevant mental health professionals present as well. Intervening before you know what pathways and triggers are coming into play is akin to a hunter firing a shotgun randomly into the air and hoping to hit something good. The next goal is to prioritize which problems are to be proactively solved, triggers, and which skills are to be proactively taught, pathways. Then to determine the specific roles each adult is to play in helping with the Plan B problem solving and teaching. Even if the initial action plan goes well, the whole crew should reconvene periodically to gauge progress, revisit triggers and pathways, adjust goals, and revise the action plan accordingly. In creating the action plan, it's important to bear in mind some of the principles discussed in earlier chapters. First, there is no quick fix. It's worth repeating, you don't fix a reading disability in a week. And you don't fix this learning disability in a week either. Second, ensuring good communication among adults is absolutely essential. All the adults who interact with a child must have a clear understanding of his unique difficulties, the skills to implement Plan B, and knowledge of the action plan. Third, blaming doesn't help. When things are going poorly at school, parents have a tendency to blame the school staff, and school personnel have a tendency to blame the parents. Blaming misses the important point. The child is frustrating all of us, and none of us has done an incredible job of helping him yet. So let's see if we can put our heads together and come up with a plan that incorporates the best we all have to offer. Let's apply the above Plan B principles to a very common trigger, homework, which may well be the most common cause of explosions. Many explosive children find homework to be extremely frustrating, perhaps because they don't have any brain energy left after a long day at school, or because their medication has worn off, or because they have learning problems that make homework completion an agonizing task, or because homework, especially long-term assignments, requires a lot of organization and planning. Thus, it's no accident that these children often exhibit some of their most extreme explosiveness while they're trying to do homework. Do these difficulties render some children incapable of completing the same homework assignments as their classmates? Sometimes, does having a child explode routinely over homework help him feel more successful about and set the stage for future completion of homework? No. With Plan A, the teacher is simply insisting that a child complete his homework, regardless of the toll it takes on the child and on the folks who are enforcing the teacher's will at home. With Plan C, the teacher is dropping the homework expectation completely. And with Plan B, first, we're going to operate on the assumption that if the student could do all the homework you've assigned, he would. Then we're going to get a good handle on the factors, including pathways, that are contributing to the child's difficulties on homework. Then we're going to apply the expertise we've obtained from the preceding chapters and engage the child and/or his parents in a Plan B discussion. Here's how it might sound with a parent. Teacher. Empathy, proactive Plan B. Miss May, I understand that homework has been very difficult lately. Mother, Homework has been very difficult for a very long time. You're the first teacher Jimmy's had who's expressed any interest in what we go through with homework. We spend several hours fighting over homework every weeknight. Teacher, I'm sorry about that, but let's see if we can come up with a plan so it's not so terrible anymore. Mother, you can't imagine how nice that would be. Teacher, now I know Jimmy has a lot of trouble with writing. Safe to assume that's part of the problem with homework? Mother, writing's a problem. And there are some assignments that he just doesn't seem to understand at all. Teacher, can you give me a sense about which assignments seem to be hard for him to understand? Mother, science. Definitely science. Sometimes social studies. Math he gets done in about 10 minutes. Teacher, clarifying empathy. Yes, we've noticed math seems to be his thing. But we've got writing troubles and problems with science and social studies. Interesting, those are the subjects that also require the most writing. Do you think it's the writing or the material? Mother, I think it's both. Teacher, well, let's take our problems one at a time. Let's start with the easier one. I've read Jimmy's IEP, and of course, I've had him in my class for about 6 weeks now. And I can't say I have a perfect handle on which parts of science and social studies are hard for him yet. So I'm thinking you can help me figure it out. I'm thinking that, for the time being, if he's having trouble with the science or social studies homework assignment, you stop doing the assignment and write me a note letting me know what part seemed to be hard. Then I can get a sense about what's getting in his way. Then we'll figure out what to do next. Sound okay to you? Mother, it sounds okay to me, except for one part. Sometimes he's the one who's insisting on getting it done. He doesn't want to be different, and he's afraid you'll be mad. Teacher, I'll talk with him about that, so he'll know I'm on board with the plan. Let's think about the other problem. I don't want to give up on Jimmy and writing. I know it's hard for him, and we're doing the keyboarding at school, but I don't want him to think he never has to write. Mother, I agree. Teacher, let's put our heads together and think about what we can do about this. I'm wondering if we should have Jimmy be part of the discussion so we're sure we've got a solution that everyone's okay with. What do you think? Mother, sounds good to me. What's the solution to the writing problem? There are dozens of possibilities. The most important thing to remember is that durable solutions are those that are realistic, doable, and mutually satisfactory, and that sometimes the problem doesn't get solved with the first solution. Emergency Plan B is an option as well, but one you don't want to rely on too often. Ricky, age 13. I'm not working on this assignment right now. Teacher, well then your grade will reflect both your attitude and your lack of effort. Ricky, I don't give a damn about my grades, man. I don't do this crap. Teacher, your mouth just got you a detention, young man. And I don't want students in my classroom who don't do their work. Anything else you'd like to say? Ricky, yeah, this class sucks. Teacher, nor do I need to listen to this. You need to go to the assistant principal's office now. That was Plan A, wasn't it? Tricky author. Let's see what it would really have looked like with Emergency Plan B. Ricky, I'm not working on this assignment right now. Teacher, is there something about the assignment that's hard for you? Let's see if we can figure it out. Ricky, forget it. I don't do this. Just leave me alone, damn. Teacher, Ricky, listen a second. I know you have trouble with writing and spelling, and you get very frustrated when you have to do assignments where you have to write and spell. Let's see if we can find a way for you to do the important part of the assignment, letting me know what you thought of the story you just heard, which is something you're very good at, without you getting all frustrated about the writing and spelling part. Ricky, how? Teacher, well, maybe Darren would help you write down your thoughts, and you could sort of dictate your thoughts to him. Ricky, it's not worth it, No way. Teacher. Oh, yeah. I sometimes forget you're embarrassed about how you spell. Why don't we have you and Darren do the assignment as a team and just make sure he does the writing part? Ricky. You won't tell him I can't spell. Teacher. Not if you don't want me to. Ricky. Darren, let's do this thing together. Much better. You don't mind a little feedback, right? Ricky's writing and spelling problems are predictable. Let's get that problem solved by doing proactive Plan B soon. Of course, doing Plan B with an individual student is a whole lot easier if you're doing Plan B with your entire classroom. In other words, there's no downside to using Plan B with all your students. It'll be a whole lot easier if you put some energy into creating a community of learners. How do you do that? First, by emphasizing a social curriculum as much as you do the academic curriculum. Another curriculum? Don't put the book down just yet. Teachers who put a lot of energy into a social curriculum find that the community of learners they created actually facilitates the academic curriculum they need to teach. So we're talking about planned and unplanned group discussions on hearing one another's concerns, generating alternative solutions, coming to mutually satisfactory outcomes. Yes, it makes sense to interrupt other ongoing lessons to process important social issues that have suddenly erupted in the classroom. All students benefit from such discussions, but especially those who need it most. The teacher acts as a role model and provides frequent opportunities for practicing social interactions and helping one another, including peer tutoring, judicious seating arrangements, and cooperative learning. Still reading? Good. Your social curriculum also helps you celebrate and accentuate individual differences. Everyone in the classroom has strengths that can be used to help other students, and everyone has areas of weakness in which they need help. This isn't a tit-for-tat classroom. In your classroom, everyone gets what he or she needs. Indeed, because of the emphasis on individual differences, students are taught that your expectation is that they will help one another. They learn that each classmate is an integral thread in the fabric of a community of learners. Each student is working on something with Plan B rather than being overwhelmed. The teacher has a sense about the unique emotional, social, and behavioral needs of each student and a framework for trying to meet those needs within the context of the larger group. In one first grade classroom, a visitor was observing one day and noticed one child. It turns out he was the explosive one, helping another student with her math. It turns out the helper was quite skilled in math, and the helpie was not. Several minutes later, when it was time to switch activities from math to music, the math whiz became stuck. The girl he'd been helping with math calmed him down, talked to him, and helped him move on to music. Turns out she was very good at dealing with frustration, all within eyeshot of the teacher. Then the girl, apparently recognizing that the visitor might not have comprehended what was going on, came over and softly explained, "He just gets a little frustrated sometimes." A lot of teachers who wish they could be helpful to the explosive student in their classroom, but feel they don't have sufficient time to devote to him, simply need to be made aware of the help available from the most probable and willing candidates, the other kids. Teacher, I can't have different sets of roles for different kids. If I let one child get out or get away with something, my other students will want to as well. First of all, you probably have different expectations for different children already. As in families, fair does not mean equal anyway. That's why some students are receiving special reading help while others are not. Why some students are in a gifted program for math while others are not. If a student asks why one of his classmates is being treated differently, you have the perfect opportunity to do some educating. Everyone in our classroom gets what he or she needs. If someone needs help with something, we all try to help him or her. And everyone in our class needs something special. It's no different when a child needs help with flexibility and frustration tolerance. So our response to the student who asks why an explosive classmate is receiving some sort of special accommodations and assistance would sound very similar. Everyone in our classroom gets what he or she needs. If someone needs help with something, we all try to help him or her. Because you're very good at handling frustration, I bet you could be very helpful to Johnny the next time he gets frustrated. Do you really think that a child who typically behaves appropriately will decide to behave inappropriately because accommodations are being made for an explosive child in the classroom? Sounds pretty far-fetched. It follows that punishing a child to set an example for or to be fair to the others, especially when there's no expectation that the punishment will be an effective intervention for the child being punished, makes little sense. In a community of learners, the academic or behavioral idiosyncrasies of one student are an opportunity for his or her classmates to help and learn, not to follow suit. The other students are waiting to see if you know what you're doing, not to see whether you're good at treating everybody exactly the same. And since everyone's different, why would the goal ever be to treat everyone exactly the same? Children are actually pretty good at understanding the fair does not mean equal concept, and at making exceptions for children who need help. In my experience, it's much more common that adults are the ones struggling with the principle. Drama in real life. Running on empty. We can't let Casey keep running out of the room, the school principal said gravely. It's dangerous, and we're responsible for his safety. It was March of Casey's first grade year, and the principal was presiding over a meeting that included Casey's teacher, occupational therapist, guidance counselor, special education coordinator, parents, and psychologist. Casey was blowing up a lot less often at home, but there were still some kinks to work out at school. Well, the psychologist said, as you know, in some ways, Casey's leaving the classroom is more adaptive than some of the other things he could be doing in response to frustration, like tearing their room apart. But I agree, it's very important that he stay safe. What's making Casey act this way? Asked the classroom teacher. What's his diagnosis? Well, I don't think a diagnosis will tell us much about why he's acting that way, but I think it's safe to say he's having a lot of trouble shifting from one mindset to another, and that he's not very good at solving problems, the psychologist said. So why does he run out of the classroom? Said the teacher. Because he can't think of anything else to do, the psychologist said. I think we need to start solving some of the problems that are causing Casey to get so frustrated that he can't think of anything to do but run out of the room, said the psychologist. But he may not stop running out of the room completely yet, so we may need a place where he can go to settle down when he does feel overwhelmed, so he doesn't end up in the parking lot. The special education coordinator chimed in. I think we should have consequences if he leaves the classroom, she said. I don't think it's good for the other kids to see him leave when he's frustrated. Why? Have any of the kids expressed a desire or shown an inclination to leave the classroom when they're frustrated? The psychologist asked. No, said the teacher. Do we think Casey is leaving the classroom because he'd rather be out in the hallway all by himself? The psychologist asked. I don't think so, said the teacher. He's always very eager to come back in as soon as he's settled down. Do we think that punishing him after he leaves the classroom will have any effect on his behavior the next time he's frustrated and feels the need to leave the classroom? The psychologist asked. I don't know, said the teacher. It's almost as if he's in a completely different zone when he's frustrated. Then I'm not certain why we'd punish Casey for leaving the classroom, the psychologist continued. Especially if the main reason we're doing it is to set an example for the other kids. So what do you suggest we do when he gets frustrated? Asked the special education coordinator. I think most of our energy should be focused on what to do before Casey gets frustrated, not after, the psychologist said. When Casey's frustration with a particular task or situation is predictable, we can solve the problem that's routinely frustrating him ahead of time so he won't get to the point where he needs to run out of the classroom. If we should happen to run into any unpredictable frustration, I think we need a place for Casey to go to calm down if your initial efforts to calm him down don't do the trick. I don't think he's at the point yet where he's able to talk things through when he's frustrated, although we're working on it. Luckily, he's pretty good at calming down on his own if we leave him alone for a while. We have to find ways to let him do that while still making sure he's safe. So for now, our top priority is to keep explosions to a minimum, even at the expense of his learning. It's the explosions that are getting in the way of Casey's learning anyway. Things went quite well for Casey for the last few months of that school year. At the beginning of the next school year, the group reassembled, including his old and new teachers, reviewed what worked and what didn't the previous school year, and agreed to try to do more of the same, while focusing on helping Casey complete more schoolwork. Although we expected some rough moments as Casey adjusted to his new teachers and classmates, it wasn't until 2 months into the school year that he had his first series of explosions. The special education coordinator hastily called a meeting. "We think Casey has regressed," the principal said. "He looks as bad as he did last school year." "Actually, we think he looks a lot better than he did last school year," said Casey's father. "In fact, we were happy he started off as well as he did. He was really looking forward to going back to school. I think we need to revisit the idea of consequences," said the special education coordinator. "Do you folks say anything to him about this behavior at home?" she asked the parents. "Of course we do," said the mother, a little offended. "We let him know very clearly that it is unacceptable, and he gets very upset because he knows that already. Believe me, this is being addressed at home." "Is he exploding a lot at home?" said the principal. "We haven't had a major explosion in months," said the father. "We'd almost forgotten how bad things used to be." "I still think Casey needs to know that at school, life doesn't just go on like nothing happened after he has an explosion," said the principal. "I agree," said the special education coordinator. "What did you have in mind?" asked the father. "I think after he blows up, he needs to sit in my office and talk it over," said the principal. "And until he does, he shouldn't be permitted to rejoin his classmates." "I don't think he's ready for that yet," the father said. "Well," said the special education director, "whether he's ready or not, it's important that the other students see that we disapprove of Casey's behavior." "His classmates don't already know you disapprove of his behavior?" the psychologist asked. "We think we need to send a stronger message," the special education coordinator said. "We think he can control this behavior. I think we should use consequences only if we believe that they will help Casey control himself the next time he gets frustrated," the psychologist said. "Otherwise, consequences are only likely to make him more frustrated." "We have to do what we think is right in our school," said the principal, ending the discussion. Casey had a minor explosion 2 weeks later. He was escorted to the principal's office. The principal tried hard to get Casey to talk about his frustration. Casey couldn't. The principal insisted, setting the stage for a massive one-hour explosion that included spitting, swearing, and destroying property in the principal's office. Another meeting was hastily called. "I've never been treated that way by a student," said the principal. "That we can't accept that kind of behavior." "Casey already knows that behavior is unacceptable," said the mother. "Sometimes he can talk about what's frustrating him right away, and that's a recent development. But most of the time, he can't talk about it until much later, and then we have to give him some time to collect himself before we try to help him." "I tried that," said the principal. "When he was in my office, I told him that I wasn't going to talk to him until he was good and ready." "How did he respond to that?" the psychologist asked. "That's when he spit on me," said the principal. "I guess that tells you that something about what you said made him more frustrated, not less," the psychologist said. "You don't think having him sit in my office will eventually help?" asked the principal. "I'm very uncomfortable having him blow up and then watch him go happily out to recess and rejoin the other kids without there being some kind of consequence. I'm struggling with this." "I think sitting in your office would work great if Casey experienced it as a place where he could calm down rather than as a place where he's asked to do something he can't do yet, namely, talk about things immediately, or where he feels like he's being punished for something he already knows he shouldn't have done. So why doesn't he just tell me he knows his behavior is unacceptable? Asked the principal. I don't think Casey can figure out why he behaves in a way he knows is unacceptable, interjected the father. After this recent episode, he was very upset. That night, he practically begged me to give him more medicine so he wouldn't act that way anymore. The assembled adults were silent for a brief moment. But I can't give the other children in his class the idea that they can do what he does and get away with it, said the principal. I honestly don't think that the students who are flexible and handle frustration well are going to start exploding just because they see Casey getting away with it, said the psychologist. And he's not getting away with it. If you're teaching Casey how to deal more adaptively with frustration and solving the problems that cause him to explode, his classmates see that you take his explosion seriously, that you expect him not to explode, and that you know what you're doing. They won't think you know what you're doing if you make things worse. Did Casey run out of the classroom again during the school year? Yes. To a designated desk in the hallway he knew was his chill-out area. Did he begin returning to the classroom much more rapidly after he left? Absolutely. Did he hit his principal again? No. Did he hit his classmates a few times? Yes, just like many of the other boys in his class. Did he continue to have trouble shifting gears? Yes. Sometimes. But his teacher demonstrated to Casey that she could help him when he became frustrated, and Casey thrived in her class. One day, I asked the teacher, "Do you think Casey's difficulties affect his relations with his peers?" She replied, "Oh, I think he's well-liked, despite his difficulties. I think the other kids can tell when Casey's having a rough day, and they try to help him make it through." Chapter 12. Now is the time. We've come a long way in 11 chapters. We started by taking a close look at different interpretations of and explanations for explosive behavior in children, emphasizing the fact that these interpretations and explanations greatly influence the ways in which we respond to such behavior and attempt to change it. You were encouraged to think about an explanation that represents a departure from conventional wisdom, namely, that explosive children are not choosing to explode, nor have they learned that exploding is an effective means of forcing adults to give in to their wishes, but rather are delayed in the process of developing the skills that are critical in being flexible and tolerating frustration. You were also encouraged to try on for size, a new philosophy. Children do well if they can. This is an important philosophy, for it suggests that if your child could do well, he would do well. In other words, he's already motivated not to explode and already knows you don't want him to. So using conventional reward and punishment strategies, consequences to give him the incentive to do well or teach him that he shouldn't explode doesn't make a great deal of sense. These strategies often only heighten the likelihood of explosions. And perhaps most important, these strategies don't teach him the thinking skills he lacks. You were introduced to pathways, skills that need to be taught, and triggers, problems that need to be solved. Next, we began thinking about how to teach those skills and solve those problems while simultaneously reducing the likelihood of explosions and at the same time trying to help your child meet your expectations. You were introduced to three options for pursuing problems or unmet expectations with your child. With Plan A, you're imposing your will, thereby pursuing your expectations but heightening the likelihood of explosions and teaching no skills. With Plan C, you're dropping the expectation, at least for now, thereby reducing the likelihood of an explosion but pursuing no expectations and teaching no skills. And with Plan B, you're doing the name of the approach described in this book, collaborative problem solving, thereby pursuing your expectations, reducing the likelihood of explosions, and teaching your child skills so that eventually he can do well in the real world, without your help. You read that there are two forms of Plan B, proactive B and emergency B. Because explosions are actually highly predictable, you learned that you should be solving most problems by doing proactive B. We also reviewed the manner by which Plan B can be applied to sibling interactions, examined family communication patterns that can interfere with successful implementation of Plan B, and briefly discussed medications that are sometimes useful in addressing some of the pathways. And we took a look at how Plan B can improve life in school classrooms in an era where the news media reports on preschoolers being suspended from school and elementary school children being taken from school in handcuffs. Surely the time has come for a new way of doing things. If you've been trying to implement this model in your home or classroom, you've probably been working pretty hard. That's okay. You were working hard already. Let's just make sure you have something to show for all the hard work. Just remember, it can take a while. You don't fix a reading disability in a week, and you don't fix this learning disability in a week either. But if things aren't going as well as you'd hoped, seek out someone who can help you. Someone who knows that children do well if they can. Perhaps you're wondering what happened to Jennifer, star of the Waffle episode, which is where we started 11 chapters ago. She's working as a nanny to a 1-year-old child while she figures out what she wants to do next. Does she still get pretty frustrated sometimes? Yes. Does she still explode? No. I used to spend so much energy being upset. Then I realized it wasn't doing me any good, she said recently. Now if I get upset about something, a lot of times I'll just stop for a second and ask myself if being upset is going to make things any better. I've learned I have a pretty obsessive personality. If I'm upset about something, I can spend a lot of time thinking about it. So I try to do things that will take my mind off what I'm upset about. Jennifer's mother often reflects on the road she and her daughter have traveled together. I want people who have a child like Jennifer to know that there is light at the end of the tunnel. The road isn't always easy, even today, but things are far better than we ever thought possible. Jennifer often thanks us for not giving up on her. I did have to come to grips with the fact that I didn't get the child I hoped for, and I had to have different priorities for Jennifer. Some things that I thought mattered a lot really didn't matter at all. Not in the scheme of things. Not with this child. And I know this is going to sound crazy, but I had to start finding humor in my situation. It's easy to get so wrapped up in the moment. But it's the big picture that matters. I held my family together. My marriage survived. My other kids turned out okay. And Jennifer is a wonderful young woman. If you've also been thinking, shouldn't all children be raised this way? The answer is, but of course. You see, while the CPS model has its roots in the treatment of explosive kids, it's clear that it's not just explosive kids who need help identifying their concerns, taking another person's concerns into account, expressing frustration in an adaptive manner, generating and considering alternative solutions to problems, working toward mutually satisfactory solutions, resolving disputes and disagreements without conflict. All kids need help with these skills. We have the technology, 5 pathways, 3 plans, and 3 steps for doing Plan B. If not now, when? If not you, who? Children do well if they can. If they can't, well, now you know what to do.
This has been The Explosive Child, a new approach for understanding and parenting easily frustrated, chronically inflexible children. Written by Ross W. Green, Ph.D. Narrated by Jessica J. N. Wells.
Copyright 2014
by Ross W. Green.
Production copyright by Ross W. Green.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.